Linda, this is tape number one, made at Winston-Salem, July 9, 1966. I'm talking to Mr. Joe Hamer, director of Richard Stockton's Till the Daybreak. Joe, I'm going to start with a first question that's fairly general, and you can be as general or as specific as you like. A question in two parts. First, I would like to ask you, in terms of your experience with this play and with the other outdoor production that you've done, whether specifically written for a locale or whether a show that was simply put on outdoors, what do you find to be the greatest advantages of outdoor production? And second part of the question, what do you think are the greatest disadvantages?
Well, let me talk specifically about this play. The reason that this one excites me so much is because the locale of the play is adjacent to the locale in which it's played in. We've got a specific play about the founding of Salem, and here we are within 100 feet from the first building in Salem. Again, this is a play about people. It's not representational history. The audience can come here to Salem, take a look at the buildings during the daytime, come down here in the Maydell, and see these people who have lived 200 years ago in these buildings come to life. Now, granted that Dick has made them, they are fictional people, but they have three dimensions about them, you might say. They could have very well been here. Now, he has only one character who actually existed in history, but the rest of the people you felt were the people who were involved in the founding of Salem. Another advantage here is that in this bowl of the theater, we're surrounded by the trees, and we have the hill back here, which allows us to simplify our staging. They were a kind of a rustic people, and we can just blend right in and say that our whole backstage area is Salem behind us. I think this is one of the main advantages. Now, just to do a play outdoors would present a lot of problems. You would have to get, as you see, we have a very simple staging piece here. If we were doing just a regular play outdoors, I think we'd have to probably go for more indoor effects. In other words, building a proscenium around the whole theater and having no relationship to anything around it except the play that's happening within that proscenium.
Joe, do you find particular disadvantages at working outdoors? The first thing is, I guess that someone else said, that the biggest disadvantage is being outdoors, and once you've overcome that, that's probably everything else is on the credit side. I think in terms of the wind and the leaves of the trees, does this inhibit the normal changes in the speech patterns or
normally
speech levels?
Normally not. Yes, it's very true that we do have, in fact, we encounter different things every night. I would say the biggest problem that a director worries about is in the hiring of his actors to see if they have the projection to work outdoors. Since so many of our actors nowadays are trained in small theaters, and there has been so much of the internal stressed in acting rather than the externals that used to exist in the theater of how to stand on a stage and how to throw your voice, and this is the problem that you have in casting, to go out there and make it a production that the people can hear and see and watch it move. I try to be as careful as I could in casting to find people that had experience in large theaters with no help from any mechanical sources. And I think I've come up with a company that can do this. We were wondering about putting mics in here, and I thought that would be disastrous. And luckily, with the exception of maybe one or two moments in the play when somebody gets low, they're quite aware of what they're playing to and who they're playing to, and it's that old thing of playing to the little old lady with the ear pipe in the back row.
And this brings another line of thought to mind here, and maybe we can skip over and talk about it a moment. One of the purposes of this survey that we're making is to determine methods of training or gaps in training that should be filled. That is in terms of the young actors coming to you. Now, you're in a particular situation here in that you have a number of union professional actors as your backbone, and yet here you're making the same statement about them that, I say the same, at least a similar statement to what some of the other directors have said about the background experience that you have to look for before you hire the actor. I was speaking in terms of his experience in large theaters. So this becomes a leading question. Do you feel that there are gaps in the training of the young actor today in terms
yes.
of voice projection? And
yes, definitely. I think that our great revolution in the 30s when some individuals went over to Russia and discovered Stanislavski, and Stanislavski found himself being discovered and misinterpreted and becoming a father of a method, which I still haven't figured out what a method is, except the method that one employs to perfect his own work. If it works for somebody, that's fine. It doesn't work for everybody. I'm not a person who wants to blast icons or anything like that, but I think that I guess it's a maturity in the actor if he realizes that everything associated about the theater is he has to learn it no matter what. He can't just learn one little part of it. I like, first of all, people that know how to stand on the stage, how to make a cross turn or a counter, which is so necessary, especially on a stage of this size, 70 feet wide. This is played in a very presentational manner, much like Shakespeare. Now, from my own beginnings, I'm sure that I bring a lot of my own personal taste to it and my background, because I started out back in 53 when I first got my first professional experience in Yellow Springs, Ohio, where we were doing Shakespeare. A show a week in a stage very similar to this, a bare wood stage with an inner above and inner below, projecting platform, and we had a wide space of lawn that we had to project our voices against. And it took me about 5 weeks, and I finally satisfied myself when I could hear my voice coming back at me when it bounced off the trees, that I realized that evidently I was going to be a fairly heavy actor. This works to great advantages in outdoor drama. Sometimes I find that I'm very loud indoors, you know, and I don't know my own projection. But I think that this is, it's the same thing like working on film and working on the stage. You've got to find the level. And this is the actor's problem. And he can't fight it. He's got to go with it. And most of my, let's say, the younger people in this company, or some of the lesser trained people, the non-equity members here, have learned what it is to work outdoors, and I think it's been very beneficial. Now, we've had a couple of the equity people who are here and have worked, say, some total of some 60, 65 years between them in the professional theater, and have had experience in all kinds of theater, in the round, the small theater of 200 seat off Broadway, the big theater of 2,000. Well, they find the level immediately, and this is the big advantage here, is that they can offer example for these other people by being there present, and these people can watch them. It's not something that you can really sit down and talk to them about, but they can watch these other actors work. And they can.
Do I interpret you correctly, Joe, in that you're suggesting that the younger actors that come to you, or that you screen — I wasn't speaking of those in particularly in the play, but the ones that you screen — come to you with too little variety in their experience?
That's right.
Based on the time that they've had available?
That's right, and also what phase of theater they become most impressed with. I find that the young actor becomes immediately impressed with what's going on in the contemporary theater and has no knowledge of what went on before. A lot of the young actors, you know, take a look at the 19th century, which we have kidded about the big hambone acting and the big splash and splurge of the actor manager, and they say, well, you know, this is past. But how past is past? I think for outdoor drama, you have to search back and find out what some of these people talked about and did, because it happens to apply very validly in this kind of work.
Of course, when we speak of schools, we're speaking to a large extent of the approach of research before application.
That's right.
Now, do you find, and I hear you're mentioning an item of research that the actors seem to be, the young actors seem to be lacking in, do you find that the young actor that comes to you, or do you even require that your actors do some research on the parts and the period that they're playing?
Yes, I require that they do. Luckily, here in Salem, they had everything available to them. I mean, it's not like if they were playing a dock worker that they'd have to go down to the docks and live like that for a week or something to get any atmosphere. Here they've got it around them. It's present all time. And I think it infects them without even them knowing it, probably. That's where we're lucky here, because it's specifically related to this play. But I'm not too much on this business of researching the inner motivations of an individual. If an actor works that way, that's fine. I don't know. If it's valid for them, that's good. If I get the results, like for instance, if somebody wants to say, I was so-and-so, I was born in such and such a time, and I do this, and I love my mother, and I hate my father, or something like that, that's fine if it comes out on stage, when they've got the actual line and the movement. Otherwise, I would just say, forget it and go out there and say your words. It's difficult. I mean, you know.
Well, of course, the type of research I was talking about would be the type of research that explained the use of the props as well as the environment of the times, background political attitudes of the times and
mm-hmm.
such.
Mm-hmm.
And I was speaking more in the sense of asking whether the young actors that came to you had gotten this element of training in college.
No.
Well, that's a short, quick answer, so.
No. They, most of them were more concerned with the character than what the character did. Trying to find these inner motivations and not trying to find the externals, the everyday things that these people did. Like how they, say for instance the women, how they braided their hair or, walk down the street, how they wore their skirts, things like that. They're more interested in the inner person. And I'm questioned as to how valid the inner person is, especially when that inner person in our drama existed 200 years ago. I think the only place that you can go is to the books or to the archives and check these things out and then try them on yourself, you know. But
we were talking a minute ago, Joe, about the projection mainly of the voices before we got off into the characterization. Do you find you have to ask the actors to extend gestures the same way, or do you simply work to make the gesture clean?
Well,
or is it a combination?
I don't know. I remember one of my old professors in college. I remember one phrase, and I still use it. It's called magnifying the action. And I find that is in direct relationship to the size of the theater, the gesture or the action has to be magnified to it. If you want to make a small gesture, you have to extend it and fit it to the line in the outdoor theater. If this was a smaller theater, I suppose everything would be scaled down. I mean, we'd have 250 seats, we'd have a smaller stage and everything. But when we've got a stage this big, the people do have to make broad gestures.
Do you find that in projecting voice, in projecting the visual image, that the beginning actors particularly, but this would apply to all of them, do you find that they extend or project the errors at the same time? Do you have... In other words, do you have to clean up excess motion and
oh,
such?
Oh, yes. Oh, Lord, yes. You know, that's an individual thing. You'll find one who's doing too much and one who's doing too little. You're constantly having to try and get a balance. Sometimes I hate to do it, is to make another actor, this is an ego problem, make another actor watch another actor do it. But in cases of dire necessity, I've actually sat one actor out and said, now watch how he does it. This was when we were getting down to the line and nothing else that seemed to work. I mean, you know, intellectualizing, speaking about it, coaching it, didn't seem to work until I finally said, all right, watch so-and-so. Maybe the dander was up, and finally they came out and they just did it, you know. Ironically enough, in this case, the person thought that when he did it, it would be ham-bone, and was very much amazed when I walked up to him afterwards and just smiled and said, that's good, that's very good. Of course, this caused him to wander off in a huff, but it came back the next night and did it, and then found out that there was a certain validity in what I was saying. As a consequence, his performance in this particular play improved.
Joe, I wanted to ask you about the arrangement of the playing space. I might pause here to indicate that this stage is nearly 70 feet across. It is a series of platforms with a lower thrust level that reaches out into the audience, and a step level about 2 feet above that that also reaches toward the audience, and then a long ramp of the stage with structures, skeleton or constructivistic structures on the left and right sides of the stage, with space both underneath and on top that can be played on. It's a departure from the usual outdoor drama approach, at least as this sort of thing is approached in the Southeast. And I wondered, Joe, if you'd give me some comment as to how you and the designer arrived at this and why.
Well, it was simple. The first basic thing is the script. And the script had a lot of intimate, what I call two or three scenes, which I'm not that familiar with the outdoor dramas here, but I would say that there's probably more emphasis on spectacle in the other outdoor dramas. Well, this didn't have any. We didn't have that many people on stage all the time. We would have a scene with maybe 20 people in it. We might have a crowd scene, which would utilize the whole company, and then we were faced with a series of very intimate, almost television-like, limbo-like two scenes. So it seemed to me that this was the only way to handle it. If we'd have employed a lot of extra scenery, we would have been defeating the script. So that's why we went just simply to this wood staging with the, as you call it, the constructivistic, I just call it rugged. Nothing pretentious about it. We have this tree that runs right up through a platform. It was an interesting problem presented to us at the beginning. It's a tree, it's a very beautiful tree, and nobody wanted it cut down. So I said, all right, we'll utilize it in the set. Just since it has a certain mass, let's try and balance the mass on the other side. As you notice, one platform is lower than the other. There's more constructivistic features on the stage left side than there are on the stage right. That's to balance this tree. And so this way, with this broad sweep, we can bring the whole company on into the center stage area, and we can utilize the thrust and the, I call it in the Shakespearean terms, the inner above and the inner below, but we have two of them, one on either side of the stage, as areas to begin action or areas to have action take place in. Now, for instance, we have a scene on top of the platforms. We have a scene which we utilize the platea system, where we begin the scene in the inner below and bring it out onto the main stage, keeping it contained with light. If you remember last night, the Governor Tryon scene started with Tryon in there sitting, and then the people coming in from the center area, and then moving it down to the fore stage. The barroom scene started with the noise going on in here and bringing the people out into the onto the platea. Then we have the fourth stage for crossovers, for road scenes. It's very Shakespearean in that sense. The little two scene that's very intimate right down here on the fourth stage. Then we can open it up and flood the area with light, and we've got an effect of a lot of people coming in for a great ceremony. But it was mainly dictated by the script. I couldn't see any other way to approach it except this way. Simple, straightforward,
the people themselves in the script, the Moravians, are simple and straightforward. So we had to use this to our advantage. What else have I?
I think you've pretty well covered it. I would like to ask you one thing about the placement of the peak moments in the scenes. Of course, a lot of this is dictated by the script, and you are caught pretty much within the framework of what locations you established according to mm-hmm. what's requested in the script. But do you make any particular effort to either make the peak moments of scenes and I know you are working for the focus on them, so that, mm-hmm. that becomes redundant. Let me ask the question another way. Do you have any principle of choosing, other than on the basis of the script, which of the scenes to bring toward the audience, which of the scenes to hold up on the main stage or spread across the other ramps? Now, I'm talking about the focal moment. There may be many people in the scene or only two people in the scene, mm-hmm. but I just wanted to know if there was a basic principle you had followed or if you just followed the dictates of the script.
Well, the principle was dictated not only by the script, but also like for our scene changes. Like we might have to have the actors have to change their own scenery during a blackout. Now, this may seem, you know, like, well, he's being held down to a thing like that, you know. Well, I think it's all integrated into it. With the lights, isolating, say, a scene up on that top platform, we can make our change. And nobody becomes aware that the change is being made because the script material is powerful enough, the way he's written it, to focus the attention on that area. Now, we could just as well play it down here. Yet, I think, for instance, like in the Heidelberg scene, the business of going upstairs onto the platform gives us an idea that we are transported to another area or another place. Most of the congregation scenes are taking place on the main stage with very little utilization of those platforms, only as transitional areas to bring something down to the main stage, like the Watchman we isolate up on this platform here. And the late man, for instance, who comes in and talks to the Watchman, who is way over on the other side of the stage, and they yell back at one another, while the congregation is assembling on the stage in the blackout. So, basically, the structure, for instance, of the play, like the first act, taking place in so many areas, historical areas, we just separate them by placing them in different levels. Now, the second act, a lot of the second act takes place in one area, and that area is pretty well localized by the center stage. Like, it takes place in Salem. I think you get the idea that Salem is just about right here in center stage over to these
yes,
two
that
corners.
Yes, that works. Speaking as a member of the audience, that works.
Now, for instance, the ship scene, that was a difficult one, and I thought, well, how do we do that? And it just turned out that the more I thought of doing it in this constructivistic way, that we could give you the effect of a ship and move you from the hold up to the decks, up to the wheelhouse, very simply. In fact, the lights just kind of cut it like a bowl right along here, like the bottom of a ship. And we have our sailors up here at the wheel and the captain's quarters back there. That's, of course, that's taking dramatic license. Actually, on a ship, it's reversed. But I thought the eye travels from here, from left to right to down. And then we open up the bigger picture and we get pieces of action happening there and the main action happening on the fourth stage with the Moravians. And then opening up with lights that we have the whole deck of the ship when they line up there. Augmented by the sound effects of great cannon shots going over, I think you feel like you're...
Bringing up the thought of the cannon shots, and before we run out of tape here, Joe, I noticed you did not use a great deal of bridge music, only a touch now and then to establish the mood or to lift us as at the end of the play, of course, you
mm-hmm.
use it. You have minimized the use of sound just in thinking back now the, of course, the cannon shot which we hear behind us, and then we hear it whistle by to the left or the right depending on which side of the house you are, and land behind the stage.
Mm-hmm.
It works very well, but you have eliminated the
yes,
opportunity to use bridge music across the scenes. Was there a reason for this?
Yes, I figured that any music
anything mechanically reproduced tends to distract from this particular material in this play. And I could only use it as a mood effect. I think it set up, whatever we did, it set up what was going to happen in the scene or what has happened in the past scene as a transition, like the bells from the prologue, kind of a requiem bell, and then there has been a death that has occurred on stage. There is a time for the audience to settle down. The prologue is very powerful, and now we get into the main body of the script. And when you're working in an outdoor drama of this sort, when you have to cover 400 years, say, about 400 years from Jan Hus, or no, 300 years from Jan Hus, up to the story of founding Salem, I think there'd be very little opportunity to use any bridge music. I can't think of anything except moods to establish moods and changes and transitions. The dialogue is very straightforward, and we can affect the change fairly simply and fairly quickly, so that the action becomes predominant and not the mechanics. The only real music that we have is in the little Moravian a quartet that goes on to establish a complete change of area and also a complete change of life, you might say, when we go into the Governor Tryon scene. We distinguish that by the little quartet. That's about the only music that's used, and with the exception of the little small bit of organ music in the marriage. There was a lot of music written for this, and I felt very unhappy about having to cut some of it, but I felt that it was necessary.
Joe, you have in the show some striking costumes, but the color variety is not great. You're using constructivistic, I suppose that's the right word, scenery, mm-hmm. that is painted a neutral earth color, which sets against a bank or slope behind the stage, which is occasionally visible. That's, of course, leaves and grass and bushes and trees. Was the leaving out of visual color, with the exception of the soldiers' uniforms, a deliberate thing, or
yes.
was it dictated by the script, or would
well,
you clarify
it
that?
It was dictated not only by the script, but by the people the script was about. You could have gone into symbolic costumes, but I don't know. That's getting into the realm of Alice in Wonderland and fantasy and things like that. That I don't think you couldn't make that script fit with anything really symbolic. Now, if you notice, in our prologue, we do have symbolic costumes. Those are not all actual representations, say, of the clergy in there. Also, these costumes are designed to be quickly removed. There has to be a lot of underdressing, where a man may be a Moravian in 1 minute and he's a sailor the next, because of the particular budgetary limitations that we have here. We have 29 people in the cast, and they, among them, play something like 65 roles. In the casting, we've tried to break down the people to play a similar role all the way through. If you notice our Governor Tryon character, he plays the captain of the ship. He plays the cardinal. He's never a Moravian. And we keep him in that way, and I think it works.
If I may comment here, Joe, we're nearly out of tape here, but if I may comment, the thought of carrying this particular gentleman through the similar roles all the way through is a little bit of a projection for clarity, like giving the cowboy that's the hero a white hat and the villain a black one.
Mm-hmm.
Even though this boy last night differentiated these characters, we knew who he was playing.
Right.
But at the same time, we knew when we saw him that he held a certain point of view. Now,
right.
Did you attempt to line this up in the play to
give
him all the way? So this is deliberate step.
It's deliberate. See,
this
play, as I said, had 60 characters in the beginning. And once we were limited to this, well, of course, as all theater is, it has to work with its limitations. So once Dick and I had our company budget made out, we decided that the cutting of the script from the original and the tightening and the casting had to go along this line. Ideally, like in any other production, I would like to have 20 people, or maybe say 10 extra actors if we were going to do this next year. I'd like to have 10 extra actors so I wouldn't have to do that.
But that, again, is within the realms of the limitations that are placed from the outside. You know, it's just, ideally, we don't have it. Ideally, we'd have 60 people in one
60
row.
Rows.
That's right.
Linda, this interview is with Joe Hamer, and we'll be signing off in just a moment. I want to ask him one final comment, and then we'll give you a rewind on this tape. Joe, we've talked sort of about this and that. I wonder, in terms of the improved training of people for outdoor drama performance, is there any comment that you would like to make that you haven't made it, that you feel you haven't made at this time? I'm not trying to put you on the spot. Nobody
no.
gets this tape except my office. So.
Right. No, improved training is not just for outdoor drama. It's just improved training. I think we need more and more teachers that have worked in all phases of theater. I don't think the problem here is any different than working in an indoor theater with acoustics that have to be overcome without the help of mechanical devices. That's where the training is. Say, presentational acting, or some people want to call it bombast or hambone, anything you want to call it, but the idea that once you are called upon to do something for a specific project, that you have the ability within you to be able to accomplish that. I think what's lacking in the theater is there's just too many youngsters that don't know how to come on a stage and stand there and make the actual mechanical crosses and the mechanical adjustments to the production. Maybe it's just a question of experience. Maybe you have to go with 20 years, 25 years experience working in different media. But I think that this should be touched upon in any educational area, whether it be in the professional school, whether it be in the college, whether it be in the little theater. I think this is up to the director, and up to him to get it out of the people and make them realize what they're working with.
Thank you.